Spirit Blade Underground, episode 315. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 315.
Hello and welcome to the Modern Room. Spill the man, Geek Entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Chris and Geek Sector website. Very unique community. Invited to check out ChrisandGeekSector.com. I'm Peter Franz, Spirit Blade, record producing entertainment resort, equipment, current, just by Chris Geek's Liam Eden, Live More in Christ, More in Bane, Free Goodies, Jack, Spirit Blade. On the show today, a review of X Men Days of Future Past, Comic Hate's review of the Superior Spider Man comic book series, a conversation about paper and pencil RPGs, and a boatload of listener feedback. Tons of great stuff, but we're all going to die of old age before the credits roll if we don't get started now.
My father once told me that I could use my powers to make a difference. He told me I had a responsibility to help others. He told me I could save this world. Save everyone. Then he told me, walk the gerbil, walk the gerbil. Frickin' weirdo.
In the near future, the tension between humans and mutants escalates into all-out war, devastating the entire planet. Giant mutant-hunting robots called Sentinels have successfully captured or killed nearly every mutant. Their only hope is to send Wolverine's consciousness back to the 1970s to stop the production of Sentinels altogether. But will Wolverine's efforts do more harm than good? Well, first let's talk about the story, the script, the general pace of the thing. I love this. I love this story. There was great attention to drama. It had really nice weight to it. You know, it was very, I guess, I don't want to overuse the phrase emotionally grounded, but in many ways it was, although that emotional grounding, that emotional involvement that I felt wasn't really strong until the second half. Many of the numerous characters got good moments. You know, in X-Men 3, we saw a bunch of characters, a bunch of, like, third-tier characters, and nobody was really getting the treatment that they deserved, except maybe, I guess, Wolverine or something, you know? He's always going to get his cut. But, I mean, in this movie, they had a lot of characters. They had a lot of, like, one-line cameos, too, which I was surprised about, that were really cool to see. But all the other peripheral characters were really given nice moments. In terms of both drama and in terms of action and just what their character is and what they're about, like Iceman, not a lot of drama stuff going on with that character, but he cuts loose with his powers like I've wanted to see and probably many X-Men fans have wanted to see since day one. It was a big deal in the third movie when he covered himself with ice and was finally like being more like the Iceman we know. But, oh, man, he really cuts loose. He is the quintessential Iceman in this movie in terms of what he does with his powers. It's fantastic. Let's see. Kitty Pryde, played by Ellen Page. She was in X-Men 3, and this was before she did Juno and just some of the other movies that have gotten her a lot more recognition. And so they very wisely, in light of her, you know, star power that she's gained since X-Men 3, gave her some important things to do in this movie. And she had some nice dramatic beats, too, where she could flex those actory muscles. The character Blink has some real, which I'm not familiar with, but she's got some really cool powers that in this movie are used in like crazy cool ways. It made me want to drive home and like fire up Portal on my Xbox 360. I mean, it was just, oh, I love the physics and the creativity in her use of her powers. Quicksilver, okay? If you're a fan, you knew that Quicksilver was going to be in this movie. I'm not going to spoil. I don't like to spoil, you know, elements of the movie. I try to talk in generalities, but just talk about how they made me feel. So you shouldn't have to fear spoilers from me. Let me just say, though, Quicksilver, fantastic. Not in a ton of the movie, but when he's in the movie, it's like it's his movie. I mean, it's great. Not only in terms of his character, but in terms of what they do with super speed, how they show super speed, it just whet my appetite for the Flash TV series coming up in the fall. The time travel premise of the story kept me guessing. You know, they spend most of the time in the dark future and the 1970s. Those are the two time periods really being dealt with for the most part. And that whole aspect of time travel, of trying to change history, of bringing two different X-Men movie casts together into one movie, you know, it just totally kept me guessing as to where the plot was going to go. I love that feeling. I love that feeling because I don't get it near as often as I would like. And it was great that up until the very end, I was like, man, I could see this going about five different ways from where I am right now. You know, and I had that feeling for a lot of the movie, which was great fun. It has a serious tone, but without being cute or using kind of meta humor. Like you might remember in X-Men 3 when they made a reference to the Juggernaut meme that was going out that was on YouTube. That was kind of a YouTube sensation. And they used a line from that, you know, and it was just kind of like too self-aware. It was this meta humor, like I said, and it just didn't, that movie was just kind of an empty movie in terms of its, you know, humor and a lot of other elements. Not so here, which it really could have been because it has so many different mutant characters that fans want to see. It had a great dramatic weight to it, but still some jokes. You know, it's not as funny as, like, say, the Avengers Marvel movie universe. But it certainly still has some nice little subtle gags and chuckles and stuff here and there. It just had a great tone feel all the way through. Great character motivations. There was, you know, everybody, you understood, you know, I think for the most part why they were doing what they were doing. But there were definitely some characters that stood out. Xavier stood out. Mystique stood out. To a certain degree, Magneto stood out, but those are like the main kind of, I would say, the dramatic roles, that are really given stuff to work with. There are some minor inconsistencies in the plot or the presentation of the plot. Like Wolverine's age would be, for me, chief among them. They don't really do anything. He's graying at his temples in the future world, and like, compared to him, no one seems to be as old as they should be. They don't really tell you how far into the future it is, but you kind of just figure out as you go along, oh, it's maybe not as far in the future as this kind of, like when you see this kind of dark future world of the X-Men comics, it's usually far-flung future as far as I remember. And it really doesn't seem to be that case because there are a lot of characters that are still alive that don't have Wolverine's regenerative powers that, you know, make him age more slowly. And, you know, given that, and given that they've established even in the Fox Marvel movie universe, that Wolverine ages more slowly, like he was in the Civil War and all this kind of stuff, I'm asking myself, okay, well then why are his temples gray in the future and everyone else just kind of looks, you know, maybe 10 years, 5 years older or something like that? Why is Wolverine suddenly aging more quickly or what's going on there? So it was just kind of an odd choice that they never really explained. Maybe we'll get some deleted scenes or something that'll explain that. I don't know. There was also no help in bridging from X-Men 3 or the recent Wolverine movie to this movie. There's a shawarma scene, an extra scene during the credits at the end of the recent Wolverine movie that I thought was going to be the setup, the direct setup that would directly lead into the events of this movie. But that's not the case. And I won't explain, you know, how or why or stuff like that, but there's just a lot of dots that you are left to connect if you want to connect this movie and this story to either X-Men 3 or to the more recent Wolverine movie. You just kind of have to figure out, okay, like one thing I wasn't satisfied about in X-Men 3 was the bonus scene at the end when, and sorry, this is a spoiler if you haven't seen X-Men 3, when Xavier comes back to life through this other body that was like brain dead since birth, and they just for some unknown reason been keeping on resuscitation for its whole life and stuff. And then Xavier kind of, after he dies, I guess, takes control of that body. That wasn't really clear. I mean, but that's really a fault of X-Men 3. It's not really a fault of this movie. And that's how the creators of this film felt. They're just like, well, okay, the audience knows in the bonus scenes at the end of X-Men 3 that Magneto is starting to get his powers back. And we know that somehow, even if it's never explained logically in the movie, or at least not clearly in the movie, we know that Xavier's back too. Why he would still be in a wheelchair if he's in a brand new body, they don't explain. Although my wife said, well, if it was a body that was just in a hospital all its life, then it would be all atrophied and whatever. Anyway, sorry. Again, you know, this movie had a lot to overcome in terms of some of the strange places that X-Men 3 left things. And I think if you're able to kind of bridge those gaps in your mind, and you're not expecting this movie to really kind of do a great job of bridging X-Men 3 to this movie or the recent Wolverine movie to this movie, if you're not expecting that, then I think you'll be content. This movie, you know, is its own ride, its own story for the most part, and it's a really good one. Let's see here. Casting. Let's talk about casting and the performances in general. You know, great cast, solid cast. Hugh Jackman, of course, back as Wolverine. He does a great job. He does a great job. But you know, it's funny. This movie, I think even before I walked into this movie, I was like, I think I'm ready for the reboot on Wolverine. Hugh Jackman does a great job. I'm not saying he's not a fantastic Wolverine. He is. But I'm kind of ready for a new interpretation of the character. And maybe that's because from my limited exposure of Wolverine in basically the 90s cartoon, a few 90s mainstream Wolverine, you know, in the comic stuff, and then the Ultimate Marvel Universe. My impression of Wolverine is that he is much more just kind of like brooding and just kind of like, maybe animal-like is what I'm looking for, just in general, not just when he's going berserk. And Hugh Jackman, he brings those moments out, and he's always gruff and brooding and stuff, but he also is kind of the hero a little bit, you know what I mean? Maybe part of it is how tall he is. I don't think that's it. I think it's just, you know, he just plays kind of the straight hero a little more often than I'm used to when I think of Wolverine in the comics. So I'm ready for a more animalistic or just kind of different take on Wolverine. That said, he still does a great job. I got no complaints. Now, James McAvoy is the standout performer in this movie. He does some great character stuff, some great dramatic stuff. Just in the delivery of his lines, there's some great natural... He just does a fine job with that character. Michael Fassbender, great. I mean, it's not like this one. He had a little bit more character drama going on in X-Men First Class compared to this movie, but he still does a great job, brings weight. He brings just that kind of steel cold persona to the role that he's just a great choice for Magneto. Ellen Page, of course, I mentioned earlier, brief but great dramatic moments. And then Evan Peters, who is a great and funny Quicksilver, really enjoyed him. The visuals, let's talk about visuals, action, stuff like that. The visuals were cool. They were great. Now, still lots of CGI that's hit or miss to my eye. It's like, okay, yeah, there's some CGI metal things moving around or whatever. But you know what? I didn't care. I didn't care because of how those effects moments help tell the story. They said something about Magneto's immense power or what he was driven to do or whatever. You know, whatever was going on in the action, I felt like it was propelling the tension, the drama, or something forward. It was doing something and not just being like, ooh, look at this Michael Bay coolness, you know. It was doing something that I really liked. The power level, speaking of which, of these characters, holy crap. I was just reminded, especially of Magneto. Several times I was shaking my head. I was like, dude, this guy is scary powerful, you know? And there's lots of great examples of superhero or superpowered characters in this story just cutting loose with their powers to the point where I'm thinking, frickin' look out Avengers and maybe even frickin' look out Superman. I mean, wow, these guys are powerful and really fun to watch. Great effects sequences. So satisfying, fun, and intense. As far as the music and the music goes, score is not very memorable. They do use the classic movie X-Men theme, but mainly, I think, just in the opening and closing credit sequences. I don't remember it actually in the movie. I'm not even sure they brought back the Michael Fassbender Magneto theme, which is like this bass down, down, down. I think those are the intervals. I might be a little off on that, but that was just a great, you know, theme going on in the X-Men First Class. And I don't think they actually brought that theme back. I could be wrong. I can't wait to see it again. But they did something like that. It was like this lower bass tone type of thing. Great stuff there in terms of the music. Serving the drama and not getting in the way and saying, here's a cool musical theme, you know. Let's see here. Okay, so in terms of like relevance, stuff that, you know, might lead you to worthwhile thought or conversation after you're done seeing the movie. X-Men 2 and 3 seemed to me to specifically have homosexuality in mind in their scripts. You know, X-Men classically has this theme of people not fitting in and people who are the rejects of society that don't fit in that people fear or think are weird or whatever. And from what I understand, when the comics first launched, and for most of their history, that theme has been kept very broad, because lots of different people, not just the homosexual community, but lots of different people find themselves at one time or another feeling like they don't fit in, certainly nerds and geeks. I think depending on, you know, where you're at, your religious beliefs can have an effect on that, you know, depending on what their beliefs are of others around you, your political beliefs. You know, there's all kinds of situations where people can find themselves feeling like the outcast, like the odd man out, the one that's not accepted, the one that's kind of shied away from. But it seemed to me that in X-Men 2 and 3, the writers specifically had homosexuality in mind. There was the scene at Bobby's house when his mom said, "Have you ever tried not being a mutant?" Which that kind of I don't want to say joke, but that kind of idea, that kind of thinking, in my experience, is usually connected to conversations about homosexuality, for or against it or whatever. And then also in X-Men 3, Storm really seemed to kind of be on the rampage about, like, no, nobody needs a cure. There's nothing wrong with them, you know, which I think also lends itself, you know, to kind of some of the phrases and ideas that I hear expressed in the conversation about homosexuality. But this movie broadens the theme. It doesn't seem to have any kind of homosexual community agenda or political agenda, any kind of specific agenda. I think it wisely broadens it out to deal with just the general broad theme that X-Men deals with so well, of feeling like you don't fit in with society in general. And since so many different kinds of people can find themselves feeling that way, I think that was a great choice to kind of broaden it out like that. I hope that... oh, no, wait, no, I was reading my notes wrong. I don't hope anything. Hope, though, as an idea, is more frequently considered the quintessential human characteristic in sci-fi or fantasy. I don't know if you've noticed that. I've noticed that in The Matrix. I've noticed that in Farscape, that at one point or another, humans seem to be identified as being these hopeful creatures like that. Is their quintessence, that's their greatest strength, or, you know, whatever. And the same thing is kind of going on in this movie. They bring up hope as this idea that it's part of our humanity. It's a valuable part of our humanity. It's what brings us through the tough times. You know, young Xavier in this movie is told to essentially hold on to hope to get through some difficulties. And, you know, whenever I hear that in a movie or fiction of any kind, I have to ask, well, why? Hope in what? What do you mean hope? Hope in just hope? Or just, are we just telling them, you know, just kind of fool yourself into thinking things will get better? You don't, you know, there's no reason to think things will get better, but just kind of do that. Think that they'll get better for no reason. And I'm just like, what the crap, really? I think we ought to hope in what's true. We ought to look around what's true. And if there's any reasons for hope, then it makes sense and it's good to have hope. And that's the kind of hope that has staying power even through the difficult times. Whereas if we're just trying to kind of fool ourselves through the power of positive thinking, man, that is going to break out from under you. Even so, young Xavier is told in this movie that hope will help him through the difficulty of bearing the pain of others. That's kind of a stumbling block where he's like, I can't go any further. It's just too much for me. He's told by another wiser character to basically hang on to hope, that hope will help him bear that difficulty of bearing the pain of others. And that idea really resonated with me as I personally think of investing in relationships that are difficult or draining. As a specifically introverted geek, even though I can kind of turn on what seems like extroversion maybe to you, I'm very introverted. I get recharged by being alone, by myself. And when I'm with people, even people I enjoy being with, there's a little tank that's slowly being depleted, sometimes quickly being depleted. And so when I think about, you know, investing in the lives of others or investing in a relationship that is kind of difficult or draining or something like that, I can just be like, oh my gosh, you know, why? Why should I do that? You know, why should I put myself through that? And hope is the answer. But by contrast, I think believers have a concrete reason for hope. Romans 8:28 says, and you guys know this, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together. All things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. Revelation 21:4 says, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. So one day God is going to quarantine evil. He's going to remove all evil from the lives of all who allow him to, and quarantine those who don't. And all the pain and difficulty that we endure now will be shown to be a contributing element in something amazing and good that God brings about in the future. So there are great reasons, great concrete real reasons to willingly embrace discomfort in relationship with others now. And I don't think that was a message of the movie, but that's something that just kind of the movie generated in my mind. So I don't think the movie is going to be one that is going to stimulate a whole lot of thought. There's stuff there to think about and process if you're looking or if you want to think about those kinds of things. But I don't think the movie does a whole lot of that on its own. In summary, guys, this movie was, in many ways, more than I hoped for. It was fantastic, a great experience. Immensely satisfying ending that I'm not going to tell you anything about. But it's immensely satisfying. And they can take the series freaking anywhere now, you know? And I don't know how many more movies they're going to make. I would guess, I mean, I haven't been keeping up with the rumors. I would guess that they're going to do one or two more X-Men movies. But man... And if you stick around till the very end of the credits, there is a shawarma, a bonus scene that sets up the next movie. So if you have any doubt about what the next movie is going to be about, stick around for the shawarma. And if you're an X-Men fan, you'll be like, oh, yeah. I want that movie freaking yesterday. This movie was great, left me wanting more. It had some flaws, but I had an easy time overlooking them. I cannot wait for that next movie to come out. Meantime, I'm going to go read me some Ultimate X-Men comics, maybe bust out the 90s animated series. This movie is rated PG-13 for sequences of intense sci-fi violence and action, some suggestive material, nudity, and language. And the nudity is basically just Hugh Jackman's butt. Quality. I give this quality score of 9.0 out of 10 and a relevant score of 7.0 out of 10. I want to remind you guys again to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. All great shows. These guys are doing great stuff. Go check them out. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Hi guys, this is Katja from the Netherlands, Comicate on the forums, bringing you a review of the Superior Spider-Man. This is a new run and part of the Marvel Now universe, following right after issue 700 of the previous volume, The Amazing Spider-Man. Spider-Man has never been my favorite superhero. The movies with Tobey Maguire were kind of okay, I guess, but definitely no more than that, although I have to admit I really do like the new movie franchise with Andrew Garfield playing the web-slinging hero. It's especially the Spidey comics, however, that were never able to grab me. Whenever I encountered him, that is Spidey, in other Marvel titles, I found Peter Parker and his superhero alias too teenagey, often childish even. Frankly, to me, he bordered on an annoying do-gooder who consistently failed to hold my interest for more than one comic. I had heard that with the new Marvel Now relaunch, or reboot, or reimagining, or whatever, there had been a significant change to Spidey. In his new title, The Superior Spider-Man, it was no longer Peter Parker, but his arch-enemy, Dr. Octopus, who donned the webbed costume. Now, I hadn't read any issues of the previous title, The Amazing Spider-Man, except for the Fear Itself tie-in issues, so I didn't know the origin of this storyline firsthand. But it seemed that Otto Octavius, also known as Dr. Octopus, had switched bodies with Peter Parker, leaving Peter's mind inside his own dying body while starting a new life himself in Peter's younger, stronger body. I kept hearing people talk enthusiastically about it on several of the podcasts I've subscribed to, with comments ranging from, "It's on the top of my monthly reading list," to, "That is one consistently awesome title." Then I read the first issues of Mighty Avengers. This is an Infinity Event tie-in, and I encountered this new Superior Spider-Man for the first time. Despite everything, I really liked him. This was no longer the annoying do-goody teenager, but an arrogant mystery guy in a well-known superhero suit with no clear boundary between good and evil, and with a taunting manner that annoyed the crap out of the other superheroes, which added a lot of humor for me as a reader. So long story short, I decided to go and read this Superior Spider-Man after all. And right now, I've binge-read the entire series, so issues 1 to 31. Story. Dr. Octopus had always been a supervillain, but it seems that when he transferred his mind into Peter Parker's body, there were some superheroic residuals there. Ock now not only has Peter's memories, experiences, and reflexes, but also a sense of morality that is new to him, but that he can't resist. He now actually wants to be one of the good guys, a real hero that fights the villains and protects the people. Doc Ock hasn't actually become Peter, of course, so he's still arrogant and megalomaniac and still has all of his own memories and experiences as well. Hence his ambition to be a superior Spider-Man. Not only does he want to improve on the former Spider-Man's performance and efficiency, he also demands a better life for his civilian alter ego, Peter Parker. Of course, what exactly Doc Ock defines as better is somewhat colored. It doesn't take long before he bosses everyone around, has his own minions, and is dangerously close to becoming the city's very own big brother due to his spider bots. An extra plot thread is that Peter Parker hasn't entirely disappeared. A tiny wisp of him, of which it's not clear whether it's his soul, his mind, or just an imprint of his memory, it still hides inside Peter's physical brain. This virtual Peter is fully conscious and aware, but not able to communicate with his body's thief, Dr. Octopus. He seems fated to watch and undergo everything Doc Ock says and does, powerless to do anything about it. Peter, however, isn't one to give up that easily, which adds yet another layer of interest for the reader. Likes. Writer Dan Slott heads off to a very interesting start by consistently portraying this new shady version of Spider-Man as a very different kind of wall crawler, while at the same time showing and developing different aspects of his character in each issue. What I particularly like about Superior Spidey is that the story is mostly character-driven. Of course, there are the thrilling action scenes, a lot of web-slinging and breaking of heads, and even the building of a private spider army, but in the end, these are just a colorful background to the development of this new Spider-Man's character. While he is still Dr. Octopus and still wants to rule the world, he now wants to do it by solving crime in order to keep the people safe. Of course, he goes about this in a way that is at best a mixture of good and evil methods. Meanwhile, he really respects Aunt May and improves on his relationship with her, something Peter had been neglecting. Also, he applies himself to Peter's studies and not only gains himself a doctorate, but also starts his own company, Parker Industries. And last but not least, while on the one hand his relationship with the Avengers grows more and more strenuous, he falls in love. The beauty of this budding relationship with Anna Maria, who he meets during his renewed studies, is that it is entirely authentic, true and pure. Peter, or rather Doc Ock, always makes time for her, even if she calls him on a particularly inconvenient moment, like a fight against a group of supervillains. When she's crying, he immediately comes running, anxious to fix whatever might be wrong. When Aunt May asks Anna Maria some inappropriate and hurtful questions, Peter, or actually Otto, defends her passionately, and rightly so. In short, Anna Maria may well be the one true chance he has of showing his true heroic, good side. Dislikes. I have only one rather big beef with this comic. It has ended way too soon. I mean, only 31 issues of awesomeness? Come on! So, should you buy, borrow, or skip this comic? Is the Superior Spider-Man really superior? Well, I don't know about you, but I say yes! This Spider-Man is definitely superior. At least to me. You know, from a reader's perspective. The Superior Spider-Man is a laugh-out-loud, hilarious, exciting, surprisingly satisfying read that I heartily recommend to everyone who's in the market for something refreshingly original. It has very quickly become one of my favorite comics. It's consistently awesome, it's a perfect jumping-on point for new Spider-Man readers, and I'm now definitely going to try The Amazing Spider-Man's newly rebooted title. I give the entire Superior Spider-Man run a quality score of 9.5 out of 10 and a relevant score of 7 out of 10. I've been Katja for the Spirit Blade Underground podcast, and I'm hoping to hear from you all on the Christian Geek Central forums and on my blog, comicsandgadgets.wordpress.com, with blog extras like links, featurettes, and also these podcast entries, but with background illustrations. Background music was Double Drift by Kevin MacLeod, www.incomptech.com. So thanks for listening, you've been great, and tot de volgende keer!
Okay, that hard, sticky thing you pulled off, that's part of the skull, right? And this pinkish-white stuff is the brain?
Yes. Might I suggest an alternative?
No, listen to me. We can't turn back now. I've got to know what they're thinking.
Have you considered talking to them?
All right, sew that back on. We'll give it a try.
I'm sitting down here talking to Winston Crutchfield, a long friend of the show and of mine, Winston of Critical Press Media at criticalpressmedia.com. Winston, thanks for sitting down with me again and talking.
Evening, Peter. It is always a pleasure to be with you in the underground. Although you need to do something about those DNA scans. That's a little invasive.
Yeah. I just, I only want the cream of the crop to be down here, you know. it's funny you talk about just being, knowing each other for a while. I think I've told you this before, but you were the very first person that ever bought a Spirit Blade CD. Did you know that?
I think you had mentioned that to me once before. That was that has been quite a while ago. And you know what? I heard about your project about Spirit Blade from Taylor Kent. And back when he was doing Snark Infested Waters, and I guess you had done an interview on his show. I don't know if he had, I don't know how he had come to it, but you did the interview on his show, and I listened to it. And I said, "Hey, that sounds very cool. I'll buy the disc. Maybe one day I'll even get to listen to it." And it was several months before I got to listen to the CD. We were on a car trip. We had taken vacation to go see my parents in Florida, and I brought it with me, and it was awesome. I was very impressed.
Oh, well, thanks.
Still in.
I was not intending to hijack this. It was just a little bit of trivia that popped into my head, but I want to talk about you and what you're into. And,
sure.
And at the moment, what we're going to talk about is paper and pencil RPGs, which are a well-loved part of, I want to say my past, but I hope my future. I've just kind of been in a season of life for a while with two young boys where I haven't been able to really get into a game, but I spent many years running a DC Heroes RPG. I've played a game or two of D&D and Rifts and a few other systems. But tell me what you're into, because you are really hardcore into paper and pencil RPGs. Can you tell me what draws you to paper and pencil RPGs instead of, say, board games or video games?
Well, that's kind of a mixed bag. I mean, I'm not as into the video game scene as I used to be. I made the decision a while back to go completely console gaming instead of PC gaming, and eventually, that has fallen by the wayside too. It's just one of the things that has gotten crowded out of my schedule. Board gaming has been a similar experience. That's always been something I've loved as well, but again, as life progresses, things aren't always as convenient, and your gaming group isn't always there. With pen and paper RPGs, though, the experience is so much more immersive, and in addition to being a game that you can kick back with your friends and do cool stuff and have a shared experience for, however long you do. And I know that at different times in your life, and certainly at different times in my life, our gaming has has taken different forms. These days, we really only get everybody together for a gaming group about once a month. So we really focus on getting through a single adventure in a single session, you know, 4 to 6 hours of gaming and done. And you know what? I compare that back to the glory days when, you know, of college, when everybody was living in the same, in this, if not in the same dorm, certainly on the same campus. And, you know, nobody had had things like jobs or kids or anything. And it seemed like the entire experience was a marathon gaming session. We made these intricate stories with complex storylines that I really kind of shudder to think about nowadays. But but so what has drawn me to this isn't it's more than just the immersive experiences. It's a lot of different things. I think the what has given it the longevity for me as a hobby is the fact that this is a hobby that changes as I change. Now, for a long time, probably, 6 or 7 years there, I was really into Warhammer and Warhammer Fantasy Battles and Warhammer 40K, which is a tabletop wargaming kind of thing with collectible miniatures and the like. And I discovered that a 2-year-old trumps a war boss. it just came to a point where that really wasn't practical, and you know, not everybody in the group was as into it anymore, and so that kind of fell by the wayside.
You're gonna have to clear something up. You said the 2-year-old trumps the what did you say the 2-year-old trumps?
The war boss.
Okay, now by trumpet, do you mean like your 2-year-old ate it, or it was just kind of like your 2-year-old needed time that you couldn't give to it?
It started off with, you sit over here and play in the playpen while Daddy paints his miniatures and does his modeling. And then there came a point when she crawled up on the on the table, and while everybody was focused on the action at one end of the table, and decided that if we were playing with the toys, she was going to play with the toys, and she won.
Oh boy.
So at that point, the logistics of transporting and setting up and running the game and keeping the children from interfering while you are doing these things just became too much to bear. You know, these days they're older, and that's not as big an issue. I've never really gotten back into wargaming in the same way as I did. But with the pen and paper, it's different. You know, like I said, it changes as I do. It changes as my needs do. When I had the time to just devote my life to this, it was awesome, and we were doing all kinds of cool stuff. Nowadays, when I have so much other things that demand my time, when we get together and when we can game, that's great. But when that doesn't happen, these books are still there, and they're books. They're full of cool pictures and awesome stories and just ideas that offer me as much entertainment and as much diversion on their own merits as they do being a part of my gaming experience.
So how would you, if you've got like a friend that you've known for a while, you know, you kind of know what they're into, they like geek fiction, they like other kinds of games, how would you pitch the idea of trying out a paper and pencil RPG to them? What kind of merits would you sell it on?
Well, you know, that kind of thing is really dependent on the interests of the individual. For me, when I first got into the hobby, it was, hey, you like Star Wars, right? Yeah, I like Star Wars. You know, how would you like to be in a Star Wars adventure? No kidding. You know, and then after that it was Ninja Turtles. And hey, we can do Ninja Turtles too, and then Robotech, and it was just, you know, one thing after another. So for a lot of people, the first point of connection is going to be a setting that they already love. If there is not an RPG, if there's not a pen and paper RPG out that supports that setting, chances are good there is a system that is ready for conversion to that setting. So that's the first point of approach for almost everybody. If you've got somebody who is hardcore into board games, then when you break out something like Pathfinder or Savage Worlds, which is one step up from, well, maybe not up, but one step over from a war game scenario or a board game action, and is basically a small-scale tactical simulation. And that can be really, really interesting. If you've got somebody who is really into theater and into improv and into storytelling, then you can go with systems like Fate or Gumshoe, which are really story-driven mechanics, or, you know, even LARPing, which is not something that I've ever gotten into. But those are things that are more focused on, you know, on story and on acting and on making a point of connection that way.
Now, speaking of that facet of role-playing, I learned recently about you that you have a particular interest in character archetypes in relation to paper and pencil RPG. Could you explain what you mean by character archetypes and why they interest you in the context of paper and pencil RPGs?
Well, in the context of the PNP RPG, the concept of the character archetype goes all the way back to the roots of the hobby with Dungeons and Dragons, where the first game was really a tactical combat simulator, and so what you had in that particular scenario was the need for certain roles to be fulfilled within that tactical scenario. So you need, these are roles that'll be familiar to anybody who is a fan of the online MMOs. You know, you've got the tank, you've got the buffer, you've got the medic, you've got the blaster. These are tactical roles. They didn't originate with D&D. Obviously, this has been a part of military doctrine for centuries. But when the tactical simulation was done, then they said, well, you know, there's another dimension to this game. There needs to be a story to this. So what kind of story elements can we add to these characters? And, you know, at the time, we didn't have a whole lot in the way of a pervasive culture, if you will. It was, you know, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, and that was about it. So Arneson and Gygax, the creators of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, basically looked at their major influences, people like Tolkien and Lovecraft and Robert Howard, the creator of Conan, and lifted from their stories, lifted from their materials, those aspects of characters that resonated most strongly. And over the years, what that has evolved into is the archetypal characters that we see today, this kind of shorthand for all of these concepts that go into making a genre or making a setting. So when I say I'm going to play a fantasy setting like Dungeons and Dragons, and I'm going to have the barbarian and the ranger and the paladin, well, those words are character archetypes. So you know that the barbarian is going to be this big, buff, bare-chested guy who grunts a lot and is really, really strong. Now, you can take that and you can nuance that in many, many different ways. But when you say, you know, when you say that word barbarian, it's shorthand for all of these other things. And with gaming, it enables you to quickly slip into this character to assume the kind of roles that this character would perform and act as they would act as part of creating the shared experience, creating the story, which is where all of these characters originated from. These aren't really character archetypes designed for the tactical game so much as they are story archetypes of characters that have been with us forever and ever. And it is one of the reasons that people connect so strongly to one character or another. They find something in that character that that they can identify with. And you know, as a writer, as a storyteller, you can't customize a character for every single person who's going to share that experience with you, who's going to read the book or see the show or be part of your game. Mm-hmm. But what you can do is you can draw on the strongest parts of a character archetype, give it nuances that you want to emphasize within that character, and then the viewer, the person who is experiencing that character as a consumer, will fill in those archetype, you know, the gaps of that archetype with their own experience. And so character archetypes are a very, very powerful way to very quickly immerse people into the experience that you're going to have, and to very quickly communicate vast amounts of information to you know, to the audience. So in the game specifically, what it enables me to do is to say, okay, you guys are being attacked by half a dozen street thugs. And those two words have just told the party everything they need to know. These are street thugs. You know, their pants are hanging around down their knees, and you know, they're wearing chains, and you know, they've got attitude. You know, and it's shorthand. It's effective communication. That's the that's the strongest appeal of that kind of thing, and the strength on it from the point of creating the shared experience is once you have a strong archetype that you can work with in the game, it's very, very easy to customize that to your individual needs or to the, you know, the individual experience of the player.
Okay, so now your interest in character archetypes in PnP RPGs has now worked itself out into a project you've been working on that's on Kickstarter now. Tell me about this Kickstarter you've got going on. What's the project and what's the deadline for people if they want to support it?
Yeah, the project is Opposing Forces, a Tactical Manual and Bestiary of Foes for Fate Core. It is a 192-page paper-bound and PDF resource book for the Fate Core RPG, given to us on Creative Commons license from the wonderful folks at Evil Hat. The project can be found right now on Kickstarter. A quick search for Opposing Forces or Fate Core ought to bring it up. The deadline for making the pledge is June 11th. I've got a pretty modest goal to get the book produced with a minimum acceptable level of art. And then, of course, stretch goals, too. Just the stretch goals in the project are designed to make the book an even better experience for everybody. So that's what I'm working on right now. Thank you.
So, tell me a little bit more about, like, for those that might be familiar with the Fate system, what's this supplement to it going to kind of bring to their game?
the Fate core books came out last year. They had the original book out, the core book out at Gen Con, and then they trickled out the rest of the core lineup, and it was very, very cool. The core book brings the basic rules for the game, tells you how to construct your character and how character interaction works at a basic level, and that was very good. But what they did not give me was anything to scratch my tactical simulation itch. So while the Fate core stuff is fantastic for storytelling and for getting that across, there's really nothing in there that supports in a meaningful way the kind of tactical simulation that I'm used to with games like Pathfinder or Savage Worlds. I'm a math guy. I love numbers. I love to watch them do pretty things. And so I spend the first quarter of the book talking about how the system works, how the system works tactically, and the math behind the system. And then the rest of the book is cool stuff, character concepts, character archetypes that are going to be useful in your stories, ready to go. So all you have to do is flip to the right page and say, all right, you guys are fighting orcs. Fantastic. And the research for that is already there. The stat blocks for Fate are ready to go. And the list of how these things operate on in the tactical battlefield is all ready to go. You can pick you can pick a tactic, you can pick an aspect, you can pick a skill, and go. It's all right there. It's already done for you.
Cool. So June 11th is the deadline to support it. It's called Opposing Forces. Is that right?
Yes.
And where? That is correct. Tell me one more time where people need to go to get more information about the Kickstarter.
Well, the easiest thing to do is go to Kickstarter.com and do a quick search for Opposing Forces or for Fate Core. Either one of those will bring it up. Of course, there's all of this information is on my website at criticalpressmedia.com, along with my own podcast, which, by the way, folks, does not sound nearly as good as Pater's.
Well, I do appreciate you taking some time out to nerd out with me a little bit, Winston. Thank you very much, and may all your hits be crits, sir.
Peter, it is always a pleasure to spend some time with you on the phone, and I appreciate your show of support and your interest in this. I know that we come from very similar gaming roots. My first game may have been the Star Wars RPG from West End, but the very next one I acquired was the DC Heroes role-playing game.
And, oh, nice.
It just goes up from there.
All right, folks. Well, you know what we tell you right now. Go read some books, roll some dice, have some fun. Try out paper and pencil RPGs.
Incoming transmission.
Hey, Peter. You had asked on the last show for responses about the idea of using Christian brand fiction as an evangelizing tool. And I remember you had also been asking for some people to actually call in and be brave and show you their voices, so here I am. I have not seen the Revelation Road movies that Ken was referring to last week, but in my experience, works intended for a Christian audience generally do not make good evangelizing aids. In fact, I think they can often hurt more than they help. There's a couple different reasons for this. The first being that things that are intended for a Christian audience tend to contain certain kinds of subcultural weirdness associated with American evangelical Christianity. It's one of those things where if you belong to that subculture and you've grown up in it your whole life, you don't see it. Much like you don't see your own native weirdness in anything else. Think of it like someone who doesn't know anything about Japanese culture trying to watch an anime. All these things that, if you know the culture, are perfectly normal and make just fine sense, seem just so weird and bizarre to an outsider and can really alienate them. It can make it hard enough for them to enjoy the work as a piece of art, much less to get a worthwhile message out of it. And if the message is the most important thing, cloaking it in unnecessary subcultural weirdness just makes something that's already hard even harder. Why would we do that? Second, I think that a lot of these movies and books and whatever, even the ones that do contain a gospel message or a presentation of salvation, they often don't address the issues, objections, and concerns that unbelievers have. And when they try to address them, they often don't do it very well. There's a lot of straw-manning that happens in these things, often out of naivete and ignorance, but it's still there. Much like how Ken was talking about seeing motorcycles that no outlaw biker would ever ride destroyed his ability to enjoy parts of that movie, seeing people who are supposed to portray folks like you acting nothing like you would act, saying things you would never say, and generally presenting a caricature of the subculture that you represent can really turn you off to a piece of fiction. If the person watching is seeing someone on the screen that is supposed to represent them, and they look at it and say, "I'm nothing like that," you've lost them. They are no longer paying attention. And thirdly, this is sad. I wish this was not true, but unfortunately it is the case that many Christian brand things are of low artistic and technical quality. We're lying if we say it's not. And that can further alienate an audience that you're trying to draw in. Too much of the corniness, the cheesiness, and the cheapness can make the message itself begin to look a little silly. You sit there watching it and kind of MST3K-ing it in your head, and you're not paying attention to whatever valid points it might have. I don't have the answers. I am not good at evangelism because I am not good at live human beings. But I really don't think this is the way to do it. At least not based on my personal experience as someone who did not grow up in the evangelical subculture. I think that attempting to use the Christian brand media is not the best tactic and will turn more people off than it will attract. Anyway, that's my perspective at least. Thanks for hosting the platform for this discussion, and hopefully I'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks so much, Kim. I'm so sorry that I dropped the ball and neglected to play that. I thought I'd already played your message on the show like the week after. Guys, this is a response to, if you couldn't tell, a review that, well, actually it was a response to me, not really to the review, but I asked after Ken from Honolulu's review of the Revelation Road movies. He'd made the comment in his review saying that, you know, these could be useful as evangelistic tools, and I thought that was an interesting idea. I've gone kind of back and forth over the years, and so I kind of put it out there. Well, what do you guys think? I mean, can Christian entertainment media, what's the potential there? I can't remember exactly what I said, but so Kim was responding to that, and I do appreciate that. Yeah, I'm still not sure what to think of the whole thing. I think at the end of the day, you know, when I first created the Spirit Blade, the first audio drama in the Spirit Blade trilogy, I think while I was creating it, I was seeing it in some ways as an evangelistic tool, but somewhere along the line, during its production, and then when it got to the point of, okay, now I'm going to be releasing it as a product online, I just kind of said, you know, I think this is for a Christian market. I do think that it has evangelistic potential, but I'm not going to try and put it out there as, like, you know, just a normal movie and kind of hide the fact that it's made by a Christian, primarily for Christians. And I would say my experience has probably been the same as Kim's, or at least my impression is that, just, you know, I just feel, you know, like, I don't see how people would respond to this well. But every once in a while, I'll hear stories, you know, about a person who knew a person who knew a person who really responded well to it, and they were an unbeliever or whatever, you know. And I don't have really any firsthand kind of stories of that nature. But I guess at the end of the day, where I sit is, you know, whether it's being labeled as Christian entertainment or not, if it's got this kind of Christian ministry motivation behind it, I suppose it's probably just up to the consumer, you know, the Christian consumer, to say, okay, here's this. What do I think of this? And then based on who I know and their personalities, would they be receptive to this with all the pros and cons that come with, you know, blah, that whole Christian, you know, media package or whatever. So that's kind of where I'm at with the stuff that I produce. And I suppose that's kind of how I look at just kind of Christian media in general, whether it's, you know, rock solid or, unfortunately, you know, as is somewhat common, you know, not so great. Just kind of on a case-by-case basis, look at it and say, okay, well, this is cool for me. It's cool for other believers and stuff. But I, you know, and then I go from there and think about who's in my life that might respond to it and who might not. So I think just as a final thought on that issue, I think that what I want to avoid, and what I would encourage, you know, all of us that are listening to this and part of this conversation to avoid is thinking of. It's one thing to say that media is an evangelistic tool. It's another thing to say that the media is the evangelism. What I would hate for someone to do is to listen to something I've created and say, wow, this, you know, presents the gospel really well. I think so-and-so would really respond to this well. I'm going to hand it to him and say, hey, let me know what you think of this, you know, and just kind of expect the tool to do all the evangelism. I mean, that's not the biblical model at all. The biblical model, as I've come to understand it over the last decade or so, is that evangelism is about relationships. It's about, you know, connecting with people. As Kim implied, it is a very kind of a people interaction-oriented kind of thing. All right. So now, totally different jarring topic switch, but a good topic. Greg is going to talk a little bit about Doctor Who.
Peter. Shame on you. Trying to enrage a geekdom just to make more content? Shame. I know this was all done in fun. I enjoyed it. I had a good laugh. Thank you. And may the zombies of your nightmares be toothless.
That's my new favorite expression. That's my new favorite, I think, sign off or fare thee well. May the zombies of your nightmares be toothless. That's classic. Thanks, Greg. I'm not sure what you're talking about. Maybe, I know I talked about Doctor Who a couple weeks ago and how I don't think there are really any real Doctor Who fans, since nobody sent me any segments about Doctor Who to play on the show. Maybe that's what you were referring to. I don't know. I'm still kind of... I don't know what to think. All right, so we're going to move on. All right, let's see here. Oh, yeah, I've got a message from D.N. Arrington from the forums.
Hello, Pater. This is David Arrington of the Helix Reviews podcast. Plug, you're always asking for feedback, so here I am with some feedback. Something in your Godzilla review that I found funny was that you compared Godzilla to the movie Monsters, and you said, you know, kind of showing that this one's more character-driven, this one's a little bit more, you know, special effects-driven, and, you know, how these aren't alike, which I found kind of funny, because I don't know if you know this or not, but they're both directed by Gareth Edwards, and so I thought it was kind of funny that that's the monster movie that you chose to compare it to show the differences, even though, you know, they're actually directed by the same guy. I just thought that was kind of funny. Also, whenever you're closing out your show, you're saying, you know, request a review, and I guess I've never really thought much about that, but I just watched a movie recently, and I want to request a review from you of the movie The Cabin in the Woods. It's a movie that I saw recently. It's very interesting and very unique, and I'm not entirely sure what to think about it, but I would be interested in hearing your opinion and your just general, you know, thoughts on the movie. So anyway, you want a request for a review? There you go. Cabin in the Woods. Oh, and if you think that you won't like it because it just looks like a generic, boring horror movie, It's not that at all. It's something completely different. Try it out. Anyway, thanks for the podcast. Keep up the good work. Thanks for the hours upon hours of entertainment here. I mean, if you think about how many episodes you created, that is hours upon hours of entertainment that you were providing for your fans. So, good job. Keep up the good work. And I can't wait for the next episode. Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much for the encouragement, David. I'll touch on your observation about my Godzilla review in a second. Someone else told me the same thing earlier this week. Regarding the Cabin in the Woods, I did see that. I saw it when it came out on Redbox, I don't know, a year or so ago. I was somewhere around the time that Avengers came out, I think, or a little while after that. And by the time I saw it, doing a review wasn't really going to be timely. And I was kind of on the fence a little bit about how much attention I would want to draw to it, because there was like this totally unneeded weird nudity sex type scene, and it's the kind of thing that it's like at least it's segmented, you know what I mean, so that like it's okay, all right, they're getting, you know, they're taking off the clothes, so I'll just do something else or skip ahead, you know, if you're not in the theater, and then it's over and then you're done. I think it was segmented. I don't think there was a whole lot else. It's my memory is pretty hazy on it. But you're right. It is certainly not what the trailers indicated it was. And I think that's great, except that a lot of people probably skipped out on it like I did, because they're like, oh, yeah, it's called A Cabin in the Woods. I've seen this kind of movie a million times. I don't need to see it, you know. But, you know, they're between a rock and a hard place, because if they would have included stuff in the trailer that indicated the different, unusual nature of this movie, then they would have let the cat out of the bag. And that's some of the best stuff in this movie, are just kind of like the directions they take it that you're not expecting, you know? So, like I said, my memory's really hazy, so I'm not going to do a review of it, but I will say that I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, you know, I believe outside of the kind of the unnecessary content stuff, but I remember really enjoying it, or at least being very interested in it and how it ended. I remember there being some pretty significant relevant stuff too, involving, yeah, that's right, oh, yeah, that's right, it's all coming back now. Yeah, there's some like spiritual cultish type stuff that just brings into question, okay, well, what if this stuff was real? And you know, so it's both entertaining and creative from just a geek genre, you know, standpoint, if you like geek fiction and horror and other stuff that I won't talk about because I don't want to give spoilers. It's not one that I recommend to everybody. Here's what I'd do, guys. I would go to IMDb and look at the content advisory. They usually do a pretty good job of giving you like a blow-by-blow of exactly the kind of sexual content, just presenting the facts, like, let's say, a woman's breasts are blah, blah, blah for about this much time or whatever. And they usually don't give spoilers. They do give warnings if some of their information does give spoilers and stuff. So I would go to IMDb, because my memory's hazy on the sexuality and nudity content, which is the stuff that I am most sensitive to, that I think is probably of the greatest danger of all the different content, you know, kind of things they could put in a movie to make it R. I think it's probably the most dangerous stuff. So check that out. Consider your sensitivities. If you think that you'd be okay with it, then I would recommend it. I think it's very creative and interesting. But I mean, if your sensitivities are going to keep you away from that, I would also say, hey, don't worry about it. There's lots of other great things in the world. So there's that. Really sloppy response to that. Finally, regarding my Godzilla review from last week, Ben Avery of the Strangers and Aliens podcast wrote and said, trying to figure out how you saw a different Godzilla movie than me. The one I saw was really quite enjoyable. I actually found myself saying out loud twice, that's not what they said, and I think he meant in terms of like when he was listening to my review. Granted, I like the Godzilla franchise, but I was surprised at your interpretation of the movie. Also, the movie monsters you referenced, directed by the same... Oh, excuse me, the movie monsters you referenced, because I referenced the movie monsters. He says, directed by the same guy, which Dean Arrington also told me later that he noticed as well. This, he goes on to say, this movie was two things. The Odyssey, as a father fights to get home to his family, and it is a giant monster movie that, in the modern sense, is looking at the monsters from the ground up. Unlike Cloverfield being a found footage movie, it still was following the monsters from the human ground perspective. I was surprised to disagree with you as much as I did. Of course, that's why I have my own podcast, Smiley Face. I do... He didn't, by the way, write Smiley Face. He did one of those things that's a sideways smiley face. There you go. Okay. I do wonder, he says, if the enjoyment of this movie is tied into how accepting of the human characters and their story the viewer is. So my response, first, I think you're right, Ben. The movie didn't give quite enough time and focus on the family stuff to hook me with it, which would have made a big difference for me. Until Godzilla can talk and emote relatably, which I think fans would hate, it will likely be the human story happening around him that the movie succeeds or fails on, for my tastes. Now, this email from Ben is a great excuse to give you guys a heads up and solicit feedback about something going on behind the scenes of this podcast. I wondered if my review would be met with some disagreement, my Godzilla review, for two reasons. One, I do think being a classic monster movie fan will change your perception of this movie, just as a million other preferences and life experiences changes our perceptions of art in general. All those variables mean that certain facets of an experience will stand out to us, while others will be missed or quickly forgotten. So in one sense, you and I really did see two different movies. We took in two different movies because our just kind of our life experiences and the things we're drawn to and stuff, it drew our eyes and our ears to different things in that were going on in the movie. I tried to allow for that in my review and even recommended that folks who like classic monster movies go see this one, so I appreciate you sharing your perspective and what you picked up from the movie that didn't come through in my experience of it. Secondly, I knew I was misrepresenting the tone of the movie in the way I expressed myself in talking about it, or the way I paraphrased quotes of it. My characterization of the movie was more reactionary than usual in my reviews, expressing how the movie felt to me rather than trying to accurately represent the tone of the movie in my paraphrased quotes. So I am sorry, guys, that I didn't make it more clear what I was doing there. There were several things about that review I wasn't happy with, including the audio quality and the picture quality of the video, if you saw that. So I hope to make time to work on those things. As I mentioned in my review, I didn't do as much prep before recording that review as I typically do. I was under a bit of a time crunch, in part because of time lost to adjusting to the new web camera that I'm using for the video versions of those reviews. On top of that, I honestly didn't feel like spending a lot of time thinking about a movie that I really didn't enjoy. Is that unfair? Maybe. I don't know. On one hand, I want to give you guys good information. On the other hand, I don't pretend to be a journalist. At best, I think podcasters and video bloggers are personalities, you might say, in most cases, not journalists. And in that medium, the medium of personalities, media personalities, some strong and sloppy opinions now and then breed controversy, which breeds interest and conversation. So while I don't think reviews like the one I did for Godzilla will be the norm, because I do like to prepare my thoughts and express myself a little more clearly, I'm not convinced that occasional reviews like that are inherently bad. So anyway, starting with Amazing Spider-Man 2, I've also begun experimenting with only outlining my reviews before recording rather than writing them. I was going to wait longer than this to see if anybody would comment on that, but it's been since before Amazing Spider-Man that I've posted a written review, because I haven't been writing reviews since Amazing Spider-Man 2. And this is so that the video I'm recording at the same time can have more room for my personality to come through. And it's also to cut some time off of my schedule, since recording videos and uploading them has added tasks to a schedule that has no wiggle room for extra tasks. So we'll see how that goes. I haven't heard an outcry yet. We want your written reviews. But if there is, then I'll consider going back to doing written. But going forward, that's what I'm planning on, is just video reviews and then the audio review as presented on the podcast, which is recorded at the same time as the video review. Just a little insight for you. I barely wrote any notes for Godzilla, but outlined much more for Amazing Spider-Man 2 and X-Men Days of Future Past. So those two would be better indicators of what reviews on the podcast might generally be like going forward. So I'm open to all of your thoughts on how you think I should handle reviews from this point on. Thanks also, Ben, for pointing out that Gareth Edwards directed both Godzilla and Monsters. I was shocked to learn that, and have to applaud his versatility, since apart from the basic giant monster concept, those were two very different movies in my mind. By the way, thanks for mentioning Cloverfield, Ben. That's one of the movies I tried to recall in my review but couldn't because, again, I didn't outline properly beforehand. Monsters and Cloverfield are my choices for giant monster movies, with Skyline is the other one I was trying to remember. Skyline being another that I like, but that's more of an alien invasion movie than a giant monster movie, even though it does have some things in common with one. So, all right, thanks again, Ben. Guys, I always love getting feedback from you. Between catching up and just kind of a happenstance, we had a ton this week. But don't let that slow you down. I would really love to get your feedback. You can request a review or give me your thoughts, your questions, really whatever, guys. It all helps me make this show better. You can go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer or send me an email at paeter@spiritblade.net. I want to thank Winston Crutchfield and Comic Kate for being a part of the show today, and all of those who sent in feedback. Guys, thank you so much. This is a longer show this time, but a really special one to my mind. You probably noticed there was no In Search of Truth this week, but that should be back next time. It was partly because of I wasn't quite ready to put my notes up on that, and partly because, holy crap, this show was packed. So that's it, then. Stay tuned, guys, for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, I'll have a review for you of Maleficent. Maleficent? Yeah, Maleficent. Maleficent. Will it scratch that nerd fantasy itch I'm hoping for? Oh, we'll see. And also our first installment of the Summer of Free 2014. Till then, thanks so much for making time for this show, especially today. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frenson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.net. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
All right. Time for more Farscape Shawarma. This time, thank God it's Friday again. Now, you might have noticed from watching these episodes that they don't actually put the title of these episodes in the opening credits. It's just in the menus of the DVDs or the Blu-ray. And they didn't do that until, I want to say, like the second season, maybe? Or maybe even as late as the third. All of these titles for these episodes are just script titles that they just, that the production staff used. So, and in some cases it can be a little bit harmful if, you know, at least in one that I can think of, with last time's episode, Back to the Future. I just got done watching the commentary and they were, you know, saying that, you know, you weren't supposed to know right away that the concept of the episode was time travel. But I mean, if you see that title, which you're not intended to, and people didn't see it when the show was first broadcast, you know, so they weren't kind of spoiled. But if you see that title, it does kind of spoil it a little bit. But this time the title is very fitting and doesn't spoil anything. This is one of the most memorable episodes for me of season one. It's got one of the best kind of crazy pop culture references, and I think it's the first time that someone other than John used a popular phrase or a slang of some kind from Earth, and it was funny because of how misplaced it was coming from out of their mouth. And of course, I'm talking about after they see, I think her name is Nualia or something, the creepy albino lady. After she walks away from talking to them for the first time, Aaron, you know, looks and said, "She gives me a Woody." And and of course, what she meant was the Willies. And when I saw it the first time, oh my gosh, I just cracked up. I couldn't believe that she had just said that. And they don't exactly save you from that moment right away. There's like silence after that, after she says that, where, you know, as a viewer, seeing it for the first time, I was like, did she just say what I think
she said there was this relatively long silence before John is like, what? You know, or whatever he said. So anyway, yeah, I just thought that was great. And they're just willing to be a little bit more daring in their humor, a little bit more. And I don't mean daring just because it was kind of, you know, humor of a slightly sexual nature. I just mean it's daring in that it's just bizarre, off color, you know, just off the beaten path of what humor normally is. You know, they certainly go for the bathroom humor sometimes. The humor is just unexpected in some really great ways. The worm in Crichton's belly, man, that thing was creepy going in. And, you know, I'm trying to think. I know that there's a later episode in this season that I think was clearly influenced by The Matrix. This series premiered in March of 99. And The Matrix came out in April of 1999. And already I see, you know, if you've seen The Matrix, you see that scene where they put that bug inside of him and it crawls, you know, inside of his belly. And there seems to be a very similar moment here. And I just wonder if Henson's could have possibly... I just can't imagine. It seems unlikely. It seems unlikely. But the similarity is really interesting that this worm goes inside of him and it, you know, has such a similar moment. Anyway, but both the movie... Well, now that's interesting. I was going to say, how could The Matrix have possibly influenced this? How could that scene have possibly influenced this when they were released so close together? But The Matrix was filmed in Australia, just like this show was. And they even have said in the behind-the-scenes features that there were people in the crew and the production, you know, all the behind-the-scenes production stuff that are working on Farscape in this season that were working on The Matrix. So I wonder if it was just a case of somebody working on The Matrix said, you know, that's a rockin' idea, and that idea kind of made its way over here. Anyway, interesting. But the albino lady, I totally thought when I first saw this that the actress was the same one that plays Dr. Crusher. I don't know that actress's name, but Dr. Crusher from like Star Trek The Next Generation. Yes, she's younger and she's thinner at this point, you know, than the actress would have been in 1999. But there's just something about her, even her voice, that I was like, wow, is that her? Is that, you know? And, you know, it wouldn't have surprised me, but it's not. But anyway, that's kind of neither here nor there. I thought her performance was great, though, that whoever that actress was. She had that crazy, like, single eye blink where she would, like, speak really slowly, and then she would close both eyes and then open one slowly before opening the other one slowly. It was just this weird kind of thing. Just a wonderfully eerie performance. This episode also had one of the first Aaron pilot relationship moments. You know, they're going to develop that relationship more in the coming episodes, especially in the aftermath of DNA Med Scientist. Anyway, I just thought, I'd never noticed before that this was really the first seed planted in that relationship. I won't go into details about kind of where that relationship goes, but again, it's one of several to keep an eye on. Explosive urine. I mean, again, they're going for this humor they don't shy away from bathroom humor. It's just kind of, they're just doing crazy, crazy stuff. And it's not that I thought that was like funny when I first saw it. It's not really something that I think is funny. It's just weird and organic and messy. And I just appreciate that. This show is just not clean like Star Trek is, you know? They just go for... I mean, Star Trek didn't even acknowledge, you know, that there's a bathroom anywhere, to my knowledge. I've never seen a toilet in any of the Star Trek TV shows that were on TV. I've never seen a toilet once. And these guys just embrace bathroom humor. I mean, it just couldn't make it more different than Star Trek. And then lastly, we saw a little bit more of Dargo. And again, more of his inner life revealed as he, at the end of this episode, talks about this alternate life that he dreamed of at one time, of settling down and having a family, you know. And And again, I think that's a seed being planted now that, gosh, I don't think it's going to be played out for a long time. I won't say when, because as the show goes on, you realize that no cast members are safe, and so I don't want to imply anything about anyone's lifespan. But much further along than you might expect at this point, that little seed grows into something that becomes kind of a serious part of his character and his motivations and, you know, what he wants out of life. And so it's funny because this is probably, like I said, the seventh time I think that I've been through this series. And there are just things that I'm noticing for the very first time, little seeds that I'm noticing. And I'm surprised. I'm like, wow, these seeds were planted this early on. And then they, you know, develop them a little bit more. And then they become a big deal way later, you know. Wow. It really just it makes this series, just like that first episode and just like the premiere was, it makes the series as a whole worth repeat viewings. Repeat viewings are rewarded, just as watching this series, you know, consistently one episode to the next without missing a single episode, except for IET, of course, you're rewarded for investing in that way. I think that you're also rewarded for investing in repeat viewings of the show. I'm seeing that, you know, as I come back to it now for like the seventh or whatever time this is. So anyway, that's all I really have thoughts on this episode about. It was, not like this stellar episode, but it was just, just a very memorable one for me. One of the most memorable ones of the first season. Next time we're getting into the episode that, Claudia Black says was when the first time she really started to kind of nail who Aaron was. And this is also an episode that plants seeds and introduces characters that we come back to. And it's pretty, it's a fairly pivotal episode. So come back next time as we talk about PK Tech Girl.